Welcome to the sixth episode of the sixth season of the Ubuntu podcast. In this episode, we're going to talk to Benjamin Carenza about the Open Photo Project and have command line love. Plus, We'll go over your feedback. If you're listening live, hello. You can send us messages using the chat facility on our website and in the IRC channel. I'm Alan, and joining me is Mark.
Hello.
And Tony.
Hi there.
We've got no Laura this week.
She's been gone a long time.
She hasn't made it back yet from wherever it is she's been away at.
I'm starting to think we should send her some sort of search party.
Yeah, that's probably wise. So, Mark, what have you been up to this week?
I have been setting up my Nexus 7 so that it will dual boot Android and Ubuntu.
Oh, that's quite cool.
How's that?
Well, Ubuntu is a developer preview and Android is still Android with all my data on it. Which is nice.
So did you have to unlock it to do that?
Yes. Okay, so I did have to back up my data, unlock it, restore my data.
How did you back up your data before you...
I used a honky collection of scripts on Windows.
Okay.
Sorry, there's loads and loads of tools for doing backups over ADB on Windows, but no one seems to have made a nice one for Linux yet, which is a real pain in the...
And that's even before you've rooted it. You can use those tools to do that.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought all the tools that required that you could use to back up required you to root it first, which kind of like chicken and egg. Because
no,
you have to
enable USB debugging.
Oh, okay.
And then it does it over that.
Oh, brilliant.
And then you unlock it, which wipes all of your user data, and then you can restore it and root it. But the clever bit is installing a custom recovery system, which you'd normally do if you were flashing a custom Android ROM. And then you can install something called multi-ROM, which is essentially a bootloader.
Right.
So it'll load the Android kernel. Then instead of loading the init system for Android, it'll load multi-ROM, which then either lets you carry on booting Android or select a different ROM which you've installed, which can be Ubuntu or another Android ROM or Tizen or whatever runs on the device.
How do you update the Ubuntu install? Because if you run our Phablet Flash, it'll wipe it.
Yeah, you have to manually. So you manually download the Ubuntu ROM and put it on your SD card or whatever.
Right.
In the Nexus 7, you just copy it onto the internal fake SD card.
Right.
And then you select it in the custom recovery and say add it to the add it to the boot menu.
Have you written this up somewhere?
Yes, it's on my blog.
Oh, well, awesome. We'll
my
link
blog,
to that.
Yeah. I basically just followed two tutorials, so my blog post just sticks them together really.
Brilliant. Awesome.
Alan.
BarrenFrozenWasteland.com.
Tony.
Have you done anything at all?
I've been playing with the Ubuntu SDK.
Oh yeah, how's that?
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What does it do?
For developing QML apps for the phone and tablet. Yeah, using Qt Creator. Been testing it a lot. Not a lot yet. You know, hello world, that kind of thing. But big plans.
I'm sure. brimming over with ideas.
Yeah, yeah. How about you, Tony? Done any photography recently?
Yeah, actually, I was just recently at a photography farm.
Where they grow photographers.
That's right, yes. We dig them up
organic
from the ground.
Ones.
It's a very nice posh farm where you go and stay for 3 days and do some photography and have some lovely food. And I took along a box of wine and had a really good time.
A box of wine.
Learn about the business of photography and things.
Awesome.
It was challenging, but very worthwhile.
Is it like instructional course kind of
thing?
Yeah,
it's run by a very well-known award-winning wedding photographer in the country called Lisa Devlin.
Right.
And it's a nice small group of people and you kind of get lots of, kind of one-to-one tuition and things. So really good, yeah.
Nice.
But I'm very pleased to be here. And wouldn't rather be on a farm drinking wine at all.
Excellent. Let's get on with the show.
On the line is Benjamin Carenza from the Open Photo Project. How are you doing, Benjamin?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Yeah, we're not too bad, thank you. So, tell us about the Open Photo Project. What's it all about?
So, the Open Photo Project is a open source project that was started by Jason Mathey back in 2011. It started as a Kickstarter project, with the idea that users should be able to control where their photos, tags, and other data are stored instead of using third-party services such as Flickr and Picasa Web, which limit control as to where users can, you know, store that data.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I'm one of the people who've never heard of this, and I don't know anything about it, so I will be asking the dumb questions. So the first question is, I've used Gallery, which is a PHP web hosting thing on my own VPS. Is it like that, or is it different from that?
So I'm a former user of Gallery, and I think OpenPhoto is more of the it's like an evolution of Gallery. It has all the features you would expect in, say, Flickr or Picasa, but it is open source in the nature that Gallery is. In fact, we're actually aiming to have support to import photos and data directly from Gallery.
So I could take the OpenPhoto project, grab the code from GitHub, put it on my own server at home, for example, and then my family could all upload their photos from their digital cameras, because we've all got a camera or phones or whatever, and then store it all centrally and not have to worry about some third-party service shutting down. Is that basically the premise?
That's the idea, and also the fact that you can, you know, you don't only have to choose to do it on your VPS, but you could store your data. You can host the platform itself on a VPS or even shared hosting, which is much more affordable for most folks, and then use a free service like a free account with Dropbox or Box.net to actually store your photos, or even Amazon S3.
So you mentioned it started with a Kickstarter campaign. How did that all work out? Did they get their goal, what were they asking for, and how did that work out?
I think the original amount was $25,000, and they did reach that goal. It was a successful Kickstarter campaign. And that was the initial seed money that they used to start it. Jaisun was a former Yahoo employee, so he left his day job there to actually work on OpenPhoto full-time. And there's a lineup of contributors, you know, core contributors who also, you know, spend a lot of their time but also work at great companies. Gareth Greenaway is pretty notable in the open source community, and he works on like some of our cloud stuff for Amazon.
So after the Kickstarter funding had been sort of gathered and spent, what point was the project at then, or is that still ongoing?
So the project's still on. The project's still going. I think that money's spent. I don't know the exact financials behind that, but I do know that the Shuttleworth Foundation stepped in and gave a scholarship to Jaisun and one of the other contributors to allow them to work on the project full time.
Cool. So why did you choose to get involved in this project in the first place? What appealed to you about it?
So I've been on Mozilla's Web Forward team. It's a open innovation program to try to help kickstart open source projects, and OpenPhoto was one of our first candidate projects that came through, and I really felt like they were gonna, you know, need a hand in kind of managing their community, so I was involved, you know, as a web forward member, just kind of trying to market that service at the time, and decided to stay on and volunteer as a community manager.
So what does a community manager for OpenPhoto do?
Basically I help promote and advocate for the use of OpenPhoto here in the United States. That's promoting it at different events. For instance, next month I'm going to be promoting OpenPhoto in addition to other web forward initiatives at Linux Fest Northwest. But also, helping users on IRC, trying to strike partnerships with hosting companies such as DreamHost, which we have a partnership with, and AppFog here in Portland, and just trying to grow the community and grow developers and get more people involved.
So as a user of cameras and phones that generate lots of images, what's the use case? How would I probably use this to replace something like, I don't know, Shotwell or iPhoto or something like that?
So right now we don't have desktop integration. We're hoping to either have some kind of a desktop app in the future that's on our wish list, or also we're hoping to have at some point a Shotwell plugin that will allow them to, Shotwell users to upload their photos directly OpenPhoto. Right now, you can use the web uploader, or you can also use an Android or iPhone. We have an app for both.
So I can upload all of my photos, just like throw them all at an installation of OpenPhoto, and then once they're in there, I can start moving them around to folders. What kind of management tools does it have within there, other than just storing your photos?
Right now, we have a tag system to manage photos and label them. Mm-hmm. So, but that's also gonna the management as to how you can organize your photos is rapidly expanding. We have a number of wish list items that we're working on to give users more control. Cool. And also more places to store data. One of the things that we're going to be announcing either tomorrow or the next day, but you guys will hear about now, is we're going to allow people to store photos on archive.org.
Oh, ooh, really? That's quite cool.
Yes. And also, I forgot to mention, we do support storage on DreamHost Dream Objects, which is a new service that they just launched a few months ago.
Mm-hmm. So in theory, I could have a very small VPS that's got a web server and OpenPhoto installed on it, but point it to some other third-party service which might have cheaper bandwidth or cheaper storage and have all my photos go over there.
That's exactly the idea.
Right.
That's really cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
So how does it handle if I've got some photos – or say if Alan and his family have all got their photos on there and they want to send, say, an album to some friends but not have to publish it to the world, does it support that? Is there some sort of privacy and access control that it supports so that you can share things with other people?
Yes, there's just like other services, you can have private photos and choose to share them with people privately and have a private link and cool. Password protect them as well. Also, if you have friends and family that use other more popular services and they want to make the leap to OpenPhoto, we do have support for importing photos from Flickr, Instagram, and Facebook right now.
Cool. So why was it important that this project was an open source project?
Because, the nature of the project is to give control and choice to the user. And open source projects, that's generally what they're about, is to allow people to have control over the software that they use. And this is, it's just kind of the nature of the project is to be open, and let users decide.
And have you had, has there been a lot of success in growing the community? Obviously, I hope from your point of view there is, because you've been managing the community. But yeah, has there been success in getting beyond the sort of core team contributions from the community?
We have regular contributors who come in, the core folks, and then we do also have people who just come in and submit a patch and whether it's to our documentation or just the PHP source code base that we have. And, we may never see them again, and we then have new people that come in. So we have a regular flow of contributors and a lot of people that are, new every day that are interested in the project.
That's cool.
Are you looking for people with specific skill sets at the moment?
We can always use people who can hack on PHP since it is a web project. I don't know as far as the other – we do have some sub-projects. Like we have a WordPress plugin that looks like it's a little outdated that could use some work. We're still looking to get a charm for Ubuntu server developed. So there's a number of ways you can contribute, the main one being contributing some work to the existing project and/or one of the sub-projects.
I noticed that both – not just the core of the project, which it looks like it's been – branded Trovebox, is that right?
So that's the hosted service, is so that's kind of an idea, is if you don't want to manage it yourself, we do have a hosted service in that you can let Jason and his folks go ahead and take over and host everything for you.
Right, but it's the same code base that's used on Trovebox as I would get if I checked out GitHub and put it on my VPS.
Correct.
Cool. And I noticed when I was just browsing the GitHub repository, and I noticed the mobile apps for iOS and Android are open source as well on GitHub, which is nice. So if people want to contribute,
that's cool.
Not just to the core app, but the mobile apps as well, there's an opportunity there as well.
Yes, and we also do have, if for those people who are interested in Python, we do have a open photo Python OAuth client. And you know, there's a lot of different things that you can work on. It looks like they're actually already working on an iPhoto plugin now that I looked down a little bit.
Oh, cool. So what can you do with the Android and iPhone clients at the moment, the apps?
You can take photos and upload them directly to your OpenPhoto, either your self-hosted or the hosted service.
Okay. And so, can you do any funky processing, make it look like it's a vintage photograph like Instagram, or does that not cover that feature set?
I don't think we're totally there yet, but that's probably going to be on the roadmap as well.
Cool. So if I go to the OpenPhoto website and download the code, what do I need to have to run OpenPhoto today?
So we support Ubuntu. The basic most common setup is going to be Ubuntu with Apache. You'll need MySQL and PHP.
So a lot like Gallery, in fact.
Yep.
Cool.
So a fairly common set of requirements, really. Yeah. Most hosting providers are going to provide that.
Yeah, just some of the base dependencies. You're going to need PHP pair and curl and mcrypt and, you know, just some basic PHP dependencies. Mm-hmm.
I noticed from the website on the community section, there's a discussion and feature requests, so people can request whatever new features they want to be implemented. And they're using a voting system. Is that? I know Ubuntu used a similar system for voting for features and bug fixes and stuff. Is this stuff actually used as a basis for what features will be developed next, or is it just a kind of wish list of things that would be nice to have in the future?
So right now it's a wish list for nice things to have in the future. What we do is we look at that list and then we import them into GitHub and create issues. Mm-hmm. And then we flag them as far as, you know, what we feel is the priority level, and then try to get to them, you know, kind of as our roadmap continues to develop out.
Right. So is the developers that work on this, who are paid developers, either through Kickstarter or charitable donations or through Trovebox, which I assume is a paid-for service, are they focused on developing developing updates specifically for Trovebox, or is it for the whole project?
It's for the entire project because it's the same shared code base.
Cool.
So what's coming up for OpenPhoto in the future?
So as I had mentioned, we are adding support for archive.org. It should actually already be in the repo, which will be announced in the next day or so. And then we have a number of different features we're working on in the front end. And let me just go and list a few of those for you guys. Some of the things that we're working on is a Shotwell plugin.
Okay.
We're still trying to get support for AppFog, which had previously been PHP Fog. So that's still in the works right now.
What does that do? Sorry?
So AppFog is a company based here in Portland, and they're a platform as a service provider. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to get support for them. They're one of the hosting providers we're working to one-click support for.
Ah, I see.
So we've talked about support for Shotwell and mobile clients, and hopefully in the future Ubuntu Phone, of course.
I thought that might come up.
You saw that coming. how about for other platforms? For example, someone who's using iOS or using Windows, will there be clients that can connect in from there as well?
Well, we do actually have an iOS client
I didn't mean iOS. I meant OS X.
I'm not sure. I don't see that at the top of our list right now.
Right.
We do have the iPhoto importing. Isn't iPhoto a Mac OS X
it
app?
It is,
or no?
Yeah. So okay. If you've got your photos in iPhoto, then you're
laughing,
really.
Yes, you could do it that way.
Awesome.
But I don't know I don't think we're actually going to be developing a native app for the Mac OS X desktop at this time.
Right. Cool. Okay. So where can people find out more if they'd like to find out about OpenPhoto?
They can go to theopenphotoproject.org and then just go ahead and click on the community section. There should be an email address at the bottom called hello@openphoto.me, and they can email us and we'll give them instructions on how to get started, or they can also just fork the repo and submit a patch.
Cool. Excellent.
Awesome.
Well, I hope you have some new engagement after talking to us this evening.
We certainly have a new user. I'm going to be putting this on my own server straight away.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us this evening, Benjamin.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Right, cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
Now it's time for some command line love.
Yay. The return of.
And this week's command line love is GeekNote.
What is that?
Well, if you have used Evernote.
I have used Evernote.
And you have an account which hasn't been hacked.
I do not. Go on.
Basically, it's... so for those listeners who don't know what Evernote is basically a cloud service for storing notes. Sort of like Tomboy,
right?
With a sink in the background, because
but you can do rich text, can't you?
Yeah, you can do all sorts of stuff. And if you paid for their premium service, you can do pretty much any kind of media. GeekNote is a command line client for Evernote, so you connect it to your Evernote account, and you say GeekNote edit name of your note, and it'll give you in your chosen text editor a markdown version of your Evernote note, which you can then edit and save back to your Evernote account, where it will sync with your other Evernote apps.
Huh.
So do you have to do anything other than use your editor and quit?
No. Save.
Save and quit. No. And it automatically syncs it up to the cloud.
And you can also create new notes in Markdown, which you'll get, and they get converted to HTML when they're viewed in your other devices.
What do you mean by Markdown?
Ah, Markdown is a sort of lightweight markup language. So rather than having to put tags around everything to show it's a heading or something like that, it's more like wiki syntax. Right. So the idea is that it's supposed to be sort of human readable. You should be able to look at it and get a feeling for what the symbols mean. So you put, like, if you want to put emphasis on something, you put asterisks either side of it. If you want to underline something, you put an underscore either side of it.
Right.
If you want a heading, you underline it with sort of dashes, and then it'll convert that to an HTML heading when it renders it, or you can convert it to other formats as well.
So why have you found this useful?
Partly because it means I can edit my Evernote notes in Vim.
And so why have you found it useful?
Ooh. And secondly, because I like marking stuff up with Markdown, because there's a lot less to type than...
And so you use Evernote to store, like, you know, whatever notes.
Yeah.
Is that encrypted somewhere? How safe is it?
Well, it's password protected, but they recently had a security breach and reset everybody's password, so I don't know. The thing is, because it's not stored on your own server, this is the one thing I've not managed to find something which I can store on my own server yet. So I compromised and went with Evernote.
So I think I'm going to add a command line love for what I do to solve this solution for next time.
Okay, then. We'll look forward to hearing about that on the next show after next.
Yes. And it's time for your feedback. Stephen Rosenberg wrote in from Los Angeles to say,
"The podcast has been going very well this season. I like the shorter, more frequent episodes. News and discussion is more timely, and everyone's nervousness over the time constraints seems to make them sound peppier than usual. Or you could all be drunk. I'm in the States and I wouldn't know one way or the other."
I'm drunk right now.
"In all seriousness, I enjoyed the interview with Elizabeth Krumbach on Zubuntu. It's a pity you aren't getting her back, as she's sort of in the middle of the whole Ubuntu community controversy. Keep up the good work, more interviews, and more quote-unquote cake." I assure you, it's real cake.
Yeah, real cake, real tea. It's as strong as it gets on this show. But there's nothing to say we couldn't have Elizabeth back on the show.
Yeah, it's not a one-time offer. Yeah. She is welcome back.
You've been on once and once only.
Exactly.
Never come back. Yeah, no, Elizabeth was a great interview, and lots of people seem to have enjoyed that one, so that's good. Nick Clark emailed in with this request.
I would really appreciate it if you could pass on any recommendations of a laptop that is available now that can be seen as especially suitable for an Ubuntu install. Nothing too exotic or expensive, but one that offers rock-solid performance would be ideal, if that's no trouble to ask. Love the show. Keep up the great work.
There's a wiki somewhere, isn't there, with a list of...
There's a hardware compatibility database.
Yeah, and that sounds like a
Ubuntu friendly. Yeah, so I personally have a ThinkPad, a penchant for ThinkPads, and they tend to work quite well, and they're not exotic. Unfortunately, they are quite expensive.
Mm. Yeah, we've got one at work, which you know is very good, but yeah, not so cheap. And the other laptop I bought recently is an Asus ZenBook, which again works very well, but is not cheap.
Does Dell only do the developer laptop officially at the moment, or do they have other ranges available?
I think there may be others, depending upon what region you're in.
Yeah, okay. Maybe if you find out what they sell to all the people in China, and then buy the equivalent model over here.
That's a cunning plan.
Then Ubuntu would work on it.
Well, I think, actually, Ubuntu is certified on every model of Dell laptop.
Buy a Dell laptop.
It's just whether they choose to sell it or not in that region. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they're all certified.
Right.
But
so
I may be wrong.
There's a fairly good chance that something by Dell would be a good way to go.
For me personally, my top two laptops are ThinkPad and MacBook Pro or MacBook Air. But they both fall on the expensive side. Mm. So the next I would choose after that would probably be actually a Dell Latitude.
Right.
Because they're quite robust. They're quite, you know, they're decent performance. They're good machines.
Cool. Well, some ideas for you there, Nick. Yeah. Hopefully that's of use.
And Philippe or Felipe left a comment on the website.
One thing that hasn't been discussed about Mir and Wayland is some of the non-technical aspects. Mir has a single stakeholder, GPL version 3 with contribution license agreement, and was developed behind closed doors for 9 months. Wayland has many stakeholders, is MIT licensed, and has been developed in the open from the start. These characteristics by themselves are enough for companies and communities to reject Mir.
Yeah, maybe.
I think the problem, or the fundamental thing here, is that Canonical don't care if other people use Mir or not. They're going to use Mir.
I'm also not entirely convinced about the whole it's GPL v3, therefore that's a problem, because the whole point of it being contributor license agreement under that code means that potentially we could relicense it under some other license.
Yes, but no, his point is that license could be a proprietary license.
It could be, or it could be a more permissive
sorry,
license.
You're
presuming.
I'm presuming that would be his concern. Yes. Or that it might be the concern of a company who wants to get involved, that because the contribution is to Canonical rather than to, say, the Apache Software Foundation, that therefore it's Canonical who make the decision about whether it gets relicensed under a more restrictive or more permissive license.
Yes, I have heard this argument a few times.
Yes.
Good thoughts.
Dave Jeffrey also stopped by the website to say,
thanks again for another interesting episode. I found Pulse Audio to be almost completely transparent for a few years now. The only place I've noticed Pulse Audio still causes problems is if you want to run Jack, the professional-grade audio toolkit. I have to issue a kill Pulse Audio from the command line to get Jack to start, which seems a bit aggressive, really. By the way, please don't change the theme music. It's perfect.
So after I said I don't have any problems with Pulse Audio last time... this week I filed a bug in Pulse Audio because on my desktop it just respawns constantly. Ooh. in Raring. I'm not quite sure what's going on there, but it's broken. Yeah.
Do we use Jack when we're recording?
We do.
Do we also have Pulse Audio running?
Yeah, it's an Ubuntu laptop. We haven't disabled it.
Right, so they seem to sit well together on your particular setup.
On my particular setup, yeah. Pulse Audio seems to get out of the way and Jack takes over and then Pulse kicks him afterwards. A man called Mark sent in this plea.
Any chance of sharing that much-discussed mutt config? Smiley face.
Much-discussed by Alan.
Yeah, all right.
This is Alan's mutt configuration, isn't it?
Yes, this is the mutt configuration that I have on my laptop so that I can access my email in a console rather than using Thunderbird, because at the time If you remember, I explained my Thunderbird was bulky and slow. So I wanted a way of using Mutt, because I actually used to use Mutt a long time ago. And I found myself very efficient with email using using Mutt. The config that I'm using is actually just mostly from Googling and saying, you know, how do I set colors in Mutt? Oh, look, there's a bit of config. Mash that into my config file. And then, you know, how do I access IMAP in Mutt? Oh, look, there's another bit of config. Mash that in. So my config file is just a mishmash of other people's config that people have put in blog posts. I'll happily create yet another blog post with a screenshot of my Mutt setup when I can point it at a folder that doesn't contain anything that you probably wouldn't be allowed to see. But, you know, that, happy to do that. But,
Chris, email to ask.
Will you cover GIMP in GUI Love? In all seriousness, though, I love GUI Love. It is important to encourage an environment that is open to all and not just the technical savvy. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, although, what do we have in the last GUI Love? It was Xtile, which is slightly geeky.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you have any suggestions for either GUI Love or Command Line Love, do let us know. Either tweet us or contact us via various
Tony
means.
Will tell you all the things in between the segments, I'm
I
sure.
Will.
He speaks very quickly.
Alistair Grant also put fingers to keyboard to tell us...
Are we running out of metaphors for getting in touch? I discovered your show only last year, but have been an avid listener ever since. During season...
Sorry, the way that sounds. I discovered your show, but have been an avid listener, even though... Even though I actually still listen. Carry on.
During season 6, episode 4, you read a letter with the listener complaining their Skype was distorted and you mentioned disabling Skype's auto-level control. I had a similar issue that wasn't simply the sound levels. The notifications were distorted regardless of how low the volume was. This happens to me sometimes when I boot my desktop. Interesting. I resolved it on my MacBook Air by running Ubuntu 13.04 by following the solution from Ask Ubuntu, which we'll link to in the show notes. P.S. Don't change your theme music. P.P.S. Congratulations to Canonical. I've been running 13.04 since early March and have only had one issue with Chrome crashing on startup.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah.
Yes. And Alistair is listening in the ISE channel live and says that we're mangling his email.
Yes. Sorry about that.
Mark is, yes.
It's nearly the end of the show.
Guilty as charged.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If there's something you think we should talk about or someone we should talk to, tweet at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And remember, if we don't hear from you, we might not have enough content. And that can only mean one thing, more quizzes.
Thanks for listening. Join us on Wednesday, the 10th of April at 19:30 UTC for our next episode.
7:30 p.m.
What?
7:30 p.m.
Yes. That's not 7:30 p.m. actually, Mark. 19:30 UTC, which is 20:30 BST. So for us in the UK,
it's 8:30. Because the clocks are changing.
Yes.
The countdown on our website will still tell you when the next live show is.
Okay. Join us then. Good luck, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.